begin the continued committee to listen to the press, and I understand we have a revised copy.
And Chair, for the record, John Lally, Office of Enterprise Technology. Yes, reflecting the conversations we had with you and a couple of other members after the hearing, we've added in a couple slides for context that we thought might be helpful to, particularly for new members, but for people for whom this is not the center of the universe like it is for us. A little bit about some of the foundational things that that we operate with and that affect the decisions that we make. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those foundations, then go into the initiative for electronic licensing, which is, the primary topic we had left on our agenda from Thursday. And then it also requested that we discuss a little bit how we're going to handle the governor's funding reductions in our base budget. After the meeting on Thursday, we met with a number of members and with the chair to talk about questions that they had or issues that they raised that we wanted to try to address. And it became obvious from some of those discussions that there were a couple of key concepts that we had not covered in our presentation that we just sort of took for granted. And most of this material is in the master plan document that has been distributed, was approved by the governor about 2 weeks ago sent out to the committee and the legislative reference library, but I'm going to very, very quickly go through these, and more as a matter of familiarization than anything else, and certainly if anybody has questions or they want to talk about this or talk about anything else later, please let us know. Get in touch with us, and we'll be happy to answer your questions. The first piece of this is really fundamental to what we're trying to do in state government, and that's the federated governance model. This came into common use with Drive to Excellence, although the concept's been around for a long time. And essentially, it reflects that there are three ways of managing IT activities in state government: utility services, shared service, and agency-specific services. And ideally, we would achieve the appropriate balance of these activities between centralization and distributed systems to give us efficiency and interoperability and the kind of effectiveness and security we really want. In the past, that balance was not there. There was an awful lot of systems and resources that fall in the category of utility and shared services that were being done over and over and over again in each agency. So I'm going to talk very quickly about this. The utility services in our vocabulary are those that serve all of state government and more in many cases. MNET, for example, serves local governments and higher education and K-12 institutions. And it's those kind of activities, networks, enterprise applications like email and collaboration tools, data centers, security, certainly, architecture and standards, the e-government foundations, strategic planning and portfolio management and oversight that are statewide functions that OET performs centrally, because that's where it makes the most sense to do those things. You achieve some economies of scale and some consistency in your technology. Most of these are done currently by OET. It doesn't mean they have to be done, but that's how they've historically been done, and in most cases that works out well for the state. The second group are the shared service functions, which are also called centers of excellence, where the systems developed for or by one agency can actually serve more than one agency, not just the individual agency. And in doing so, they become essentially almost utilities for state government, but they're not run by OET. Things like GIS systems for geographic information, data warehousing, statistical analysis and financial management, case management software, some databases, client indexes, cash processing, and accounts receivable management like the Department of Revenue does for most agencies. Those kinds of functions are highly specialized. Not every agency needs them, but it's not a particular specialization of OET, so it makes sense to have one or two or three agencies combine their expertise and their resources to develop that really well and then use it for those agencies that have need for those services. And then there will always be agency-specific services that need the subject matter expertise of a particular agency, and it doesn't make sense to centralize that. and that's things like tax administration, benefits determination, environmental management, engineering, property management, to name just a few, where just one or two agencies in state government really have responsibility for that, and they develop the systems or purchase the systems and run them, and all of the responsibility for that rests with them. Most of those systems run on OET's platform, but our services in that situation are really passive services. We just provide the environment for them to operate within. Second thing is the information architecture, and I mentioned that probably half a dozen times on Thursday without really defining what it is. Architecture in IT is much like architecture in construction. It's the body of information and knowledge and tools that are commonly accepted, have been proven over time, and help assure that the design that you create will be of appropriate quality and value, and that the delivery will be, therefore, up to the standards that you would expect. Our information architecture has really a number of different levels. At the top level is the business architecture, where we're talking about high-level business processes. So, for example, today's agenda is largely talking about e-licensing. It wouldn't be, the business architecture would not have an item, collect barber's licenses or process realtor's licenses. But license processing is the high-level business process that we'd be looking at. And there is a relatively small number of those high-level business processes in any organization. Our goal, and the goal in managing most of these kinds of organizations, is to try to reduce the number of very specific instances of business processes to an irreducible minimum. So you have simplification, standardization, and support for all of those with a single set of systems. That's an ideal. It's very difficult to realize. But the whole point is, why do you reinvent the wheel for what are essentially common processes? So we do a business architecture now, and the federal government, for example, I think has 43 discrete business processes. Some of them, like national defense, are a little bit outside the state's realm unless we decide to declare war in Iowa. But the rest of them are common at both the federal and the state level. And you will find tax administration and debt collection and license processing and things like that that exist at both the federal and the state level in the architecture. The information architecture within the overall Minnesota information architecture really gets that data, and it defines the kinds of data we collect, on whom, for what purposes, and how it's going to be captured and characterized and protected. So that ideally we would not have, as we do currently, 20 different agencies or 30 agencies collecting information on a business that is, in many cases, 90% the same information. You would define it once, collect it once, and maintain it once. That is the goal that we're working towards in the information architecture. And in that process, it becomes self-defining, so you know when you're asking for an item of information, how it's to be captured, how it's to be characterized and protected, and what the real definition of that. And that becomes important as we move to greater use of the services that guarantee that we've identified who you are and what you have rights to do within state government. So they know that John Lally is a state employee, and John Lally is a taxpayer, and John Lally is a homeowner, all have different rights within any individual system to do certain things. That's the way we protect the integrity of those systems and protect against the loss of information or duplication of information. The third is the application architecture, which is the programming languages and the development methods that we use to develop systems. Currently, there is no application architecture worthy of the name in state government. That's one of the things we're working on right now, so that we have more consistent use of tools, and that down the road yields benefits in maintaining systems and extending systems and making sure that we identify the appropriate functions that are done by those applications. The fourth level of architecture is a technical architecture, and this is what most people think of when they're talking about architecture. They think of desktop definition, database management, networks, hardware, software, the pieces of the system that are common to all applications, but that we don't tend to define very accurately. So as part of what we're doing with the Information System Standards Program, is trying to define a common set of standards that become the architecture so that we know what operating systems we're using, what platforms we're using, Windows, for example, versus Unix versus Macintosh or whatever it might happen to be, and have documented that in our procurement, then operates around those standards for both cost reduction and for efficiency of maintenance. And then finally, the security architecture, which is one that permeates the entire operation if we're doing it correctly, and it's all the practices as well as the hardware and software that protect our computing environment. This one I have to apologize for in advance. This is a diagram. It happens to be the only comprehensive diagram we have of Minnesota's information portfolio. And this is the collection of information from multiple sources about the IT environment in Minnesota. We have information going around the clock here from assets and services that are existing within Minnesota, through the applications, the software packages that we run, the architecture, the financial information on IT budgets and expenditures, and IT staffing skills, and understanding what their experiences are. And then finally, and what is probably of most interest to you in the past, has been the plan and project data. Where are we on the IT projects that are in operation? When we talk about managing Minnesota's information portfolio, it is analyzing all of this and trying to work through initiatives that leverage what we already have or what we need in common as the highest priority for our investment. We've just started to put this information database together approximately 3 years ago. We have some information on all of these areas. We have a lot of information on some of them, but it's by no means complete. And this is now something that we tie very closely into our oversight function and into the architecture function. I do not expect anybody to commit this to memory, but I just wanted you to have some idea of when we talk about the information portfolio and what's involved in managing it, this is the body of information that we're looking at.
I just have one question about people who are knowledgeable in information technology. Are they all in OET, or I think I know the answer, or are chunks of them out in departments?
Madam Chair, there are people all throughout state government that have varying levels of expertise in various technologies. It's a little like the law or medicine. Just because you know one area of technology doesn't make you expert in another. But we have expertise throughout state government, expertise in both from a formal training and from an experience standpoint in all agencies. By its nature, we have a lot of information on that other agencies don't, on mainframe activities and hosting and networks, because that's our primary business. Other agencies have a lot more expertise than we do around things like the web, for example, and developing applications for portable devices. But yes, there's expertise throughout state government.
If you go back to those first three slides, that you don't have to turn them, of the various triangles, mm-hmm. The ones we have, the shared services and the utility services and so forth, mm-hmm. If somebody, some agency wants to develop something that's sort of like that, or maybe even in that top one, the agency-specific services, and they decide they have to hire someone to do that, are you able to find somebody in state government who has that expertise, who's done the same application maybe for another agency?
We can try to point them to agencies that have that expertise. Whether they have people available is not something we would know necessarily. But even, for example, take GIS, which is one area that I know you have an interest in. There's geospatial information, systems information, which is geographic coded data. A lot of expertise in agencies like public safety and transportation and DNR and so on, along with the Department of Administration's Land Management Information Center. They are right now embarked on a process to try to create a referral network and a governance process so that exactly what you're looking for can be utilized, and utilized to the utmost, rather than recreated every time somebody wants GIS programming. So we can try to generally point people towards an area that has expertise in data warehousing, for example, but whether or not they're able to take advantage of it, that we don't always know.
Should we have more specific requirements to do that?
I think the law already requires that you're supposed to ask around, sort of. but it's not a very formal process generally. From my own experience in state government, when the legislature goes home, our work really begins as we try to implement all the things that have impact on various systems. And it's at that point that there's very little excess capability within state government. But generally speaking, if there is somebody with the knowledge, or even if there's somebody with an application that is capable of being used again, we would encourage people to do that. We do that during our review in the budget process. If we have three agencies, for example, that are coming and want, as a matter of fact, that's how e-licensing really got started. We had several requests for agencies who wanted to develop electronic licensing capabilities, each on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led to the initiative for e-licensing. We do similar things like case management and financial analysis and so on, to try to bring people with similar needs together so we buy one solution that serves their purposes instead of three.
If you have any suggestions as we finish up the session for things that would make that more formal and more effective, I'd like to know them.
Okay.
Okay.
Anyway, I tried over the weekend to find a simpler way of describing the portfolio, and I couldn't come up with one, so that's why I gave you this incredible spider diagram. But if anybody really has an interest in that, I can talk for hours on it. Probably not in this hearing. That is kind of fundamental information that affects our environment and what we're trying to accomplish from the Office of Enterprise Technology. And I've changed a couple of the other slides on e-licensing as well to try to put into the flow some things that might help you understand what we're trying to accomplish there. Because I think if you hadn't been on this committee 2 years ago when we first came with that initiative, some of that information might not be readily ascertainable by what we've been through before. The enterprise licensing system currently serves about
Madam Chair. So if I could ask a question on the spider diagram, if I can brave that terrain just a little bit. So does the portfolio management, or two questions, does the portfolio management oversee all of the layers in your tiered model? And then what is the actual governance structure? Is it just OET, or is it a broader multi-agency group that does the portfolio assessment?
Madam Chairman, Representative, I should have thrown the governance slide in here, but I didn't think anybody would want to go through that, so I apologize. The governance process we have within the executive branch includes a CIO advisory committee that works with us directly, as well as the team of executive level CFOs and deputy commissioners at an operational level, and then at the policy level, a group of commissioners that advise the CIO. And these all fit together in a very neat formula that never works quite as well as it does on paper. But essentially where we try to work together on establishing priorities and identifying opportunities for collaboration throughout the process. This model, this database is really built up within OET, drawing on information like maps and other agency and administration-wide data sources. We do the oversight of this. We prepare the report on this document, which was distributed, I think, last week to the chairs of the committees. It's about a 400-page document. If you really want it, it's on our website also as being available to the Legislative Reference Library. But it has as much information as we've ever put together in the executive branch about the state of IT in Minnesota. It's still not where we want it to be, but it's getting closer. And hopefully the next iteration will be even better. Much of what we get, though, is not independently verified information. It is self-reported information from the agencies that we've brought together in one space. And it helps give people an idea for the possibility and the complexities of the IT environment in state government. But that document, I'd be happy to send a PDF to you. We'll print out all 400 pages of it, but...
if I could, thank you, Madam Chair. So the application side of it, then, kind of the top of the pyramid, does a large agency, for example, like Human Services, bring all of its application initiatives into the portfolio, either as information or for kind of consideration and evaluation, or are the agencies pretty much on their own for their kind of program-level application tier?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's probably a combination of both. We've asked every agency in the executive branch to designate the mission critical applications that they have, several hundred applications across state government, that they then have to do. We have a structured evaluation process that looks at both the technical condition of that application. Is the hardware and the software current? Is it outdated? Is it meeting needs? And then also the business need and impact of that. So we're looking at both, is it good enough to do what they need to have done? Is it working well in spite of the technology? And then they use that as the basis for their request for upgrading or replacing or combining software. But that's all done according to that evaluation system by the agency. And the only time we get involved in verifying that information is if it's in an audit situation. Or if they've got a major system request coming in through the budget process that we review. So we get information on budgets, on their planning processes and the results of that plan, on, all of the information that's identified within here. And we try to review that with the agencies, but it's not a formal process. We don't have the resources to do that on a regular basis.
Okay. Representative Biggin, and then after this, I think we're going to try and let Mr. Lawley get through the whole presentation. But
he's
starting to get a little panicky about time.
I'm envisioning people laughing like that skit on Saturday Night Live with the computer. I don't know if anybody's seen it, but anyway. I just don't deal with computers that often. But my question, and Representative Downey, I kind of had some questions along the same lines. Specific to software, if there is a universal program that all departments could use, is that done, or again, is it kind of a combination of both, where sometimes they're on their own, sometimes they're not? I mean, I don't have a specific software program in mind, but if everybody has a reporting duty, that's the same. Do they use the same software, or again, are they kind of on their own to come up with what fits their needs?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, again, it's kind of a mix. For specific applications that are unique to an agency, we will help them if they ask for our help in identifying the appropriate solutions. But for the major common applications, we have on the master contract that we've set up beneficial licensing agreements for most of the major packages that agencies would want. And what the market doesn't define is the majority of them are standards too, so that we have a couple of word processing and office suites that are available to agencies. We have a couple packages in statistical analysis and a couple in most of the major categories. And they're free to choose from among those and get the benefits of the ordering process for that.
One more follow-up, Madam Chair, is if you knew of a new software, or if they, through a conference, or just because they stumbled upon it, found a new software that was more efficient, if you guys found it, do you recommend it? Or if they find it, do they come to you and say, hey, this would be, a cheaper way or a more efficient way of doing this kind of universally? I mean, do those kind of conversations occur?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, in the process of putting together that master contract under ISRM, all the agencies, or most of the agencies, participate in that process and they have opportunities to influence what goes on that list. We typically don't make recommendations. We don't have an R&D function that analyzes and evaluates software. The population of software out there is simply huge. So some agencies do that kind of work for their own specialty. Human Services does some of that, for example, looking at the areas that they serve. I suspect the engineering people in MnDOT do the same thing. But we don't have that simple responsibility.
Okay.
Electronic licensing. Current state, as I said, there are about 300 professional, technical, and business licenses that are issued across the executive branch, with over 500,000 issuances each year, which is a high volume of licensing. There are many different manual and electronic systems that are used here. Some of them fairly modern, some of them haven't changed much since the licensing began. And even among the automated systems, there's not much consistency and much integration across them, so they all proceed independently. So if you're a small business and trying to start up a business that happens to touch environmental and health and human services and employment and all these, you'll have to go. You may not have to go to each different agency as an independent exercise in licensing, but they have different ways of approaching licensing systems, different interfaces, different ways of paying. And one of the things that we're trying to do with the electronic licensing system is create a common interface for those and a common set of support structures, which I'll talk about in just a moment. The project goal, as we articulated it originally in Drive to Excellence, and again 2 years ago in front of this committee, create a one-stop online shop, which it sounds very good and very trendy and everything, but it really is intended to reduce the burden on citizens for complying with the state's regulatory structure. And as we have said, I think consistently, the cost of government is not just the cost of state agencies, it's the cost on the citizens to comply with the regulations that we put into place. And by having a web-accessible system that is optimized for efficiency from the standpoint of the citizens, we enable them to do the things we demand of them without the requirement that they come down to a state office during our business hours and fill out paperwork and process that paperwork. It works for us from an efficiency standpoint, but no longer are citizens forced to comply with our operating environment and come to our offices. Essentially, you get the independence, as we've talked about it in our master plan, the independence of time and space to do business when it suits you rather than when it suits the government. But we're building also into this system controls and safeguards that haven't existed consistently in the past to protect identity, both the identity of the information about citizens and the identity of people coming in and creating a new licensed personal persona that may or may not represent the real person, depending on how they are interacting with the system. So we create an environment that is secure, that has the identity protection, and that is accessible at people's convenience. And we think that's essentially where the technology is really serving people directly. Big question, why now? Well, this is actually a question for 2 years ago. Why then? 2 years ago, we were trying to create a system with the secure foundation for electronic government services. E-licensing is one of the first applications to go on that e-government foundation, and to try to eliminate some of the inefficiencies and the inconsistencies across agencies in that. And to that effect, in the last 2 years, since you first gave us the appropriation for e-licensing that we used to create that foundational portion of the system, we have been working to create an identity management system that will serve the government across agency boundaries. We want to make it easier to do business. Obviously, everybody has an interest in seeing that the burden of compliance is reduced and that the path for companies or professionals trying to establish themselves is eased in this process and reduce the inefficiencies within agencies. But it's also part of Minnesota's attempt to remain, to both be competitive and to appear to be competitive in supporting businesses and professionals who are trying to do startup work in the state of Minnesota. Just to give you an idea how widespread this is, this map is, I think, about 8 months old, so I'm not sure if it's entirely current, but for a good portion of the country, e-government portals with electronic licensing capabilities exist and are in operation right now. And Minnesota is not there yet, but we're getting there. That's why the difference in the color on this. But we hope to be one of those states that offer comprehensive e-licensing at the conclusion of this project. Essentially, this has gone back now 4 years to Drive to Excellence. The original plan that we offered was to fund the basic functionality for e-licensing, all of the functionality, through the appropriation process, but there wasn't enough to go around 2 years ago. So what we've created is essentially that secure foundation of identity and access management, and if you have questions about that, I refer them to Chris Boozy. And then to come up with a business plan for how we could bring, after the pilot project is over, bring other agencies on with the users of those license systems paying the cost to bring those systems into the system. So we started out with a $7.5 million infrastructure appropriation 2 years ago, and that's what we've been operating on for the past 2 years. With a public-private partnership, we manage the project on behalf of the Department of Labor and Industry, and the first pilot agencies have come online in the last couple months. The way it's supposed to work, and this is the new addition to this, citizens are going to have access to e-licensing through a common web portal, so they don't have to figure out where in state government they have to go for the licenses that they need. They'll come in through the portal. That portal will have some shared EGS functions like directory and IAM, which is identity and access management, which is a long-winded term for the security to make sure that you are who you say you are and that you have a right to do the things you're doing and to track through that throughout the system. Based on that, you'll then go into a common electronic government services interface that will interact with what we call legacy agency EGS systems, which is the old systems that existed, and some new EGS systems for agencies that either have manual processes and have to build a new system, or agencies in the past few years who have built a new system. And this will include a number of functions like registration, payment, account management, appeals, requests for information, and licensing. All of these would operate off this common platform for greater efficiency and consistency, and all would go through that identity management process at the front to make sure that people are who they say they are and are doing what they're supposed to do. Then there'll be the interaction with the business processes within the agency, because almost every agency has to do something. They have to evaluate your professional credentials or understand what your continuing education requirements are or whatever. All of those business processes will work through the electronic system, but the determination remains with the agency as to whether a license should be granted or not. All we're doing is providing the functionality to support that licensing arrangement. The basic challenge that we're trying to do in our component of this, in addition to providing the hosting for that interface, is to make sure that the identity and access management function works well. And that identifies who you are, who you really are, not just who you say you are, where you're located and what your access method is for the system, how you're getting into the system, what you're trying to do within the system, and why. And by centralizing that function and making sure that it's working in all cases, you both protect the integrity of the licensing system, but you also protect the information, the privacy of the information on citizens within that system, which is equally important. The pilot phase is nearing completion. We've brought on the post board, chief officer standards and training board, and emergency medical personnel licensing. Post board went up, I believe, first, and EMS has gone up. Over 1,000 transactions have been processed successfully. The foundation is largely in place, although obviously it will have to be extended as other applications come on board. And as this whole thing gets better integrated, we'll be able to also provide more information to people about what licenses they need in case they don't already know the licenses they need. And if you're somebody starting up your first business, that by itself can be a daunting task, just figuring out what regulations apply to you. This way you're integrating the information that the state makes available to people trying to start up a new business with the systems that they use to take care of their license requirements. At the start of this whole process, we had licenses scattered across agencies manually, some of them operating with limited over-the-counter hours, a lot of paperwork, not necessarily secure systems, which has been a recurring problem, and some systems that were cash and carry, where they really couldn't process electronic payments. You had to come in and write a check or pay cash for your license because there was no way to pay electronically for them. When we're done, we're going to have one-stop access, automated process, hopefully 7x24 by 365 operation, streamlined electronic workflows, and this is an important thing again for us, secure identification and access management, and finally a comprehensive electronic payment structure so that people don't have to resort to checks and cash. We think the goals that we set out to accomplish 4 years ago in Drive to Excellence for electronic licensing are still valid. The idea is that the business relationship between the citizen and the government is equalized. It's no longer citizens being subservient to the government processes that regulate the state, but rather work with us as partners, as equals in that process. And in our effort to help them, we reduce the effort it takes to comply with state requirements. I think some of the pieces that are in that set of goals, like the lack of redundancy of data, still are going to take some time to put into place as we replace existing program logic and business processes with new enhancements, but at least we'll have a solid foundation upon which to build those additional functions. From an agency standpoint, having a common application that is supported centrally will increase their efficiency, make it possible for them to accomplish their goals. We have agencies at all points of the spectrum in terms of their level of automation and their use of that automation, so for some it's going to be harder to make that adjustment. But we think in the long term, if we keep the citizens' interest in mind, that will be a trip that's well worth taking. And that's where the ultimate test of our success will be, just how well this whole system environment works for the citizens. And from our standpoint as government, we think having those goals of efficiency and environmental sensitivity, improving the use of technology and efficiency is a goal that we share with the businesses that are being affected by these, those people that are applying for their professional licenses, as well as the citizens at large who want to see that what we do is as efficient as possible. The choice we had made to do this initially was to fund, as I said, a good portion of it through appropriations and the balance of it through user fees. The business model we came into the session with in August when the budget proposals were made called for a temporary 10% surcharge and with a minimum of $10 fee on licenses that were going to be issued or renewed. The majority of the licenses that are affected by this would have a surcharge of $10 to $50. There would be a few very expensive licenses that would be more, and many that would be at the minimum of $10. We discovered in the process of reviewing this information and talking to agencies and talking to legislators that some of our data was flawed. There were a number of licenses, for example, that are out there that are no fee licenses. There's no charge to apply for them, particularly in the human services area. There's no processing charge, so either way you look at it, a $10 surcharge is an infinitely large increase for those people to pay. And in many cases, those people that are least able to afford something like that. We intended, and do intend, that this will be a true user fee, and it pays for the transition from the current system to the new system. So the surcharge would blink on when migration is imminent. We have a staged period of implementation where we're not going to try to do a big bang theory, as they call it, where we do the whole of the state at one time. We'd be bringing state agencies on in a series of steps over the next 6 years, and when an agency is expected to come into the system, that surcharge was linked on. It would pay for the cost of transition. And then after 6 years of paying for that transition in the initial operation, that surcharge would link off. We are still trying to work with the Department of Finance, or of MMB, I should say, to refine that business model. We're still talking to the various constituencies out there, trying to make it as fair as possible to people, but recognizing that this plan has been around for a few years, and that some of the agencies that have gone ahead on their own did so in knowledge that we were putting the system into place. So there may be changes to this initiative as we go on, but we will hopefully have all that information in the next week or two for you. That would affect what the licensing surcharge, the amount of it capped on it, and so on would be. The purpose of that surcharge is to cover the cost of migrating those licenses to the new system, helping the agencies do some re-engineering of their business processes to take advantage of that automation, and then provide the basis of operations and maintenance for the implementation period in a couple of years after that. At that point, ongoing costs would be of operation system would be recovered through the chargeback mechanisms that are built into our rate system, and the surcharge would no longer be in place. Any questions about the
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question about the fee. I know that we've got at least two letters here, and one from the Minnesota Association of Realtors and one from the Minnesota Coalition of Licensed Social Workers, and they're both in opposition to the fee for their particular group because they previously have participated in this kind of revenue-raising opportunity to be able to go online, or they are feeling as though it's just kind of a pass-through to get them to what they're currently doing. So I'm just raising that because I think there are people that are groups of people that are concerned about this. So I just wanted you to have the opportunity to respond to at least particularly these two groups that have raised that issue.
Madam Chair and Representative, we are aware of the opposition to, I like your phrase, revenue-raising opportunity, but we would probably characterize it more as a way of not pushing the cost off on somebody else to develop a system that serves a specific group. And we are aware that part of what has happened, of course, in the last 2 years or 3 years since this was originally conceived is a lot has happened in our economy, and we understand that. And that's why we're reevaluating this to look at what the opportunities are. But we still have to find a way, if we're going to provide that functionality to people and do it with the consistency and the security that is expected of us, we have to find a way to pay for it. And we did not think that the 10% fee was onerous, in particular on anybody, for the cost of those professional licenses. We will see whether our efforts to come up with a different business model are successful, but we are aware of these things. We've talked to the agencies. We've talked to some of the associations. I think we have a meeting with one of them this week sometime to gather more information about them. So I understand and respect their position. It doesn't help us, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. People did contact us to want to speak to this, and we said instead of doing it at the time of the governor's budget, we'll do it at the time when we're putting our budget together, and particularly now that we've heard that there may be changes in this proposal over the next few weeks. You know, I guess there's unlimited time to have everybody speaking to everybody in public at the same time, but you don't have unlimited time. So, Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lally, a couple of years ago, the Department of Commerce outsourced the licensing for insurance licenses, I think, to some firm in Kansas. Overall, I think what it did is added maybe $100 to the continuing ed process. But my question to you is, will that be, will insurance licenses would be part of this new proposal? And my expectation is probably would. So in that case, will there still be a relationship with the firm that the Department of Commerce contacted with a couple of years ago, or are we starting all over from scratch?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't think we're starting over from scratch. I believe I know the answer to that, which is that we're going to utilize the existing connections that are in place. But let me get back to you. I don't know that one in particular, and I don't want to mislead you. So let me follow up on that.
Okay. Can I ask one more question? I guess I'm concerned about the price. They said that last deal added at least $100, not initially to the licensing, but the way they were processing, continuing it. So is your expectation that this, under your system, thing, prices might be going down, or there'll be a change in how things are being done?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm trying to find it.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the 300 licenses that are managed across the executive branch, that's all licenses will be under the one-stop shop. Is that all statement really all, or are there some others that'll hang out there on their own?
No, Madam Chair and Representative, it only covers business and professional licenses. There are some areas are regulated by, for example, the court system regulates attorney's licenses. We don't in the executive branch. There are other licenses like recreational licenses, vehicle driver's license, things like that. They're not covered by this system. It's strictly professional and occupational licenses and business licenses.
And then for the ones that you went first with on the pilot, did those tend to be ones that were already in an electronic licensing format? Or I've heard quite a bit of testimony in other committees that indicates that they're moving to this new electronic licensing system, but they were already doing it electronically, and they're curious as to why they're paying a surcharge for what is essentially not a new value-added capability.
Madam Chair and Representative, my impression was that both the post board and EMS licenses were manual processes. I don't think they had automated systems in place. But I'll check on that also.
Okay. I have a question, which is when you said that slide with the dark blue states of Minnesota in light blue.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, do all those dark blue states meet the project goals that are on your slide 12?
Madam Chair, my understanding from the information that I've seen, I haven't verified it, but from the information I've seen, they all have substantial e-licensing capabilities of the kind that we're looking for. Some of them are done independently, some of them by the state, some of them are outsourced, a variety of different mechanisms for administering.
Okay.
The other area that we were asked to talk about briefly was the impact of the governor's budget proposal on OET. OET is largely funded, 92% of our budget is funded through the rate structure, which I'll talk about very shortly, and that is essentially as if we were a private business paying or having paying customers that pay us for the services we deliver. Of the balance, the 8% balance, 6% of that is general funding for IT security and funds much of our information security environment. And the other 2% is the basic operations of the agency, which includes the Office of the CIO, portfolio management and project oversight, standards, architecture, all the general governance that are part of the statewide administration of the information management process. And so our general fund hit is coming out of that 8% of our total budget. But of that, the 6% that is in information security has been exempted from that cut because we all believe very strongly that that is the most critical function that we have in the general fund, and we didn't want to hobble that by reducing it with the general fund expenditure. So that is... what is going to be happening with that is going to come out of the basic agency support functions and executive oversight functions. Just to explain the 92%, because that's what people think of when they think of our budget, it's a $90 million budget. Well, that 92% is set by a process that's a little bit complex, to say the least. The two bulwarks of that are customer inputs and oversight by the Department of Finance. There's a rate setting process that takes up about 6 months of every year, where we gather information from the agencies about their forecast of how much volume they're going to need, and that's storage capability and lines printed and bandwidth and processing capacity and hundreds of other categories of services that we provide. We have to go through then and look at what is it going to take for OET to provide that volume of service, what is it going to take us in terms of capacity and in terms of operations, and come up with a budget for that. We have to add to that the internal allocations of some of the direct and shared costs and administrative costs that go with that, come up with a proposed rate. At that point then, we've identified a product and service cost that we review with the agencies. There's a rate setting panel that is involved in identifying what the rates are for that, for each one of those hundreds of services that we provide. And that will come up ultimately with a rate per unit. And that's how we bill for our services. It's how we're compared to other sectors in terms of our competitiveness, is on the basis of that rate per unit. At that point then, the Office of Management and Budget comes in to review and give approval for that rate package, and then we start billing people for the services we provide. It's a lengthy process. It's made exceedingly complex by the detail that goes into it, but it's a relatively transparent, if not necessarily understandable, process. Overall, we're being asked to make a reduction of $1.2 million in our operating budget. I'm sorry, we've made a reduction of $1.2 million from fiscal 8 to fiscal 9 in the rate-based budget. Part of it we got through managing contracts more tightly, making better use of those master contracts for the servers and routers and things that we buy, and for the purchase services that we have from vendors as well as from utility providers. All of this combined to save our customers $1.2 million off what we had done the previous year. We've had kind of a roller coaster effect over the past 10 years of rate increases followed by rate reductions. Part of this is occasioned by the inconsistencies in the predictions of volume that we get, and part of it is by our interactions with the federal government, which are interesting, to say the least. When under the federal regulations, we cannot retain earnings for future investment. We have to turn those back into the federal government in proportion to their funding of our system, which takes us through a process of major, huge rebates to the federal government, to where we have shortfalls, to build up money and then make another rebate to the federal government, because the processes are not in sync, unfortunately, with the federal government. But that keeps us from doing what most normal businesses do, which is setting aside the money for future changes and investment in replacement of technology. So it's kind of a feast or famine situation with us. But we've managed to make some improvements in the operations in spite of that all, and have generally been trying to keep competitive in most of the services we provide. For this coming year, we have a reduction of $606,000, a 5% base level reduction in our general fund budget. We're eliminating 4 FTEs out of our central administration functions. 2 of them are coming out of the portfolio management and oversight function. The other 2 are largely in support functions to supplement our activities at the Office of the CIO. And as far as the planning and oversight portions of this, we're exploring some alternatives right now to how to get keep those functions going at a good level that we can sustain through bill backs to agencies, or building them into the rate structure, or allocating overhead, or whatever strategy we can come up with if they're not going to be funded generally.
Terrific job. And I want to thank all the committee members and the staff and the audience and everyone who was able to come here at this time. We still do have the minutes before us. The representative probably needs the minutes.
I do.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, the minutes are accepted. And I just have one one question. Can we, now that different people are in charge of the federal government, can we fix up that mess? Couldn't we have just done it in one of these? Couldn't that have just been an earmarked process instead of an earmarked appropriation in one of these bills that have come by? Can't believe you're the only state, we're the only state who thinks this is a silly thing to do. And
sure.
Also, which doesn't make any sense, is that I know from having had federal grants in the far away past, is that they've got a substantial overhead charge on any grant that you get from the federal government. And as far as I understood, at least at that time, there are very few restrictions at least that were beyond the imagination of the university of how they were used. So,
Madam Chair, our CIO, Gopal Khanna, has been in Washington frequently, representing both Minnesota and the National Association of State Chief Information Officers, and has been in consultation with the Obama administration and others. We have hopes of influencing that process. I personally have not been called by the President for my advice, but I'm more than willing to share it if he does. We're trying to find ways of making this whole overlapping system work better. I used to believe that was easier to make happen than I've been able to see it done in my career, but I'm hoping to see some improvements as we go forward. And part of what we're trying to do is to model at the local level what we'd like to see happen at the federal level. And hopefully can convince them by our example that there are better ways of doing things than the way they do them now. However, there are some things about the federal system, like their use of the allocation overhead, that I'd like to see us embrace here, but we're working through those issues now. I would offer also one of the things that came up in our meetings with several of the members last week and with the chair. When we've been promising now for a couple of weeks that as data is available on both the data center and on any changes that are made in the e-licensing, to go through those business case arguments with you and the financials with you, it's kind of a self-imposed torture if you want to go through that, but we might offer this, that if the committee would like to meet all of you or some of you with us and go through those financials when they become available outside the committee meeting structure, we'd certainly be willing to do that. And I would suggest you coordinate that with the chair.
Okay. Any other last-minute comments? Again, my thanks to people participating. Meeting adjourned.